This is the Head Torch podcast. Welcome. Our mission? To create a mentally healthy culture at work. Keeping the conversations alive, our podcasts bring you great presenters and stimulating discussion on mental health and well-being in the workplace. Enjoy.
So welcome everybody to the Wellbeing Hour with me, Amy McDonald.
And me, Angus Robinson. We'll introduce you to our guests in a few moments. We have Karen Ann Duffy, Dennis Fishbacher-Smith, and Julie Nerney. As you settle in, a heads up, we are recording this, so you will be able to watch it, listen to it, share it later. Please do follow us on those podcast channels. We do appreciate it, and it always makes a difference. At Head Torch, we work with companies and organisations to create a mentally healthy culture. The Wellbeing Hour is an important extension of our work. I'll be back later and we'll field some of your questions to our guests. Amy.
And what guests we have. We are so excited today to be hosting our first panel event here on the Wellbeing Hour. And there's lots to talk about, as I'm sure you're aware, under the heading of Stop Wellbeing Washing, Start Walking the Talk. And for those of you joining us live in the chat, you will see a question that we're inviting you to respond to. And our key question today is this: what do you do to call out wellbeing washing in your organisation? So do please add your responses to the chat and any other comments, questions, and Angus and I will be dipping into those in due course together with our guests. Panel members then, thank you so much for joining us today. And we have for you today, folks, Karen Ann Duffy, who is the HSE and Sustainability Manager with Volvo Construction Equipment and Chair of their Global Mental Health Community of the whole of the Volvo Group. On top of all her responsibilities last year, Karen Ann simultaneously completed and was awarded a first-class honours in business management. Her career in health and safety is driven by her interest in people and their stories. We have Professor Dennis Fishbacher-Smith, Research Chair in Risk and Resilience at the University of Glasgow and formerly the Deputy Head of the Business School there. Dennis is a graduate of no fewer than seven universities, a Chartered Fellow of the CIPD, amongst many other professional bodies. He's been a non-exec director. He's been seconded to the police for work around resilience and counter-terrorism, and he's an expert advisor on some high-profile cases. We have also on our panel today Julie Nerney, who is a serial entrepreneur, transformation leader, and non-executive director at the UK Supreme Court. Julie is a fellow of the Institute of Directors and has taken the lead in some complex change programmes. Amongst many other accolades, she's a guest lecturer at the Oxford Said Business School for the Global Leadership Development Programme, and she is the author of not one, but two business books. So pleased to have you with us here today. Let's kick off with a bit of show and tell. Karen Ann, share your mystery object and tell us three things that it says about you.
Thanks, Amy. My mystery object is a book. So for those of you who have seen me working from home, I've got a wall of these behind me. It says I'm an introvert at heart, really. So after a full week of being on at work or a big social event, I just like to recharge with a book. It's my favourite thing to do. I read mainly sci-fi, fantasy with a little bit of crime thrown in. So it's all about escapism for me and just being surrounded by creativity. And the most important thing it says about me is that I just really, really wish that dragons were real and existed in the world.
Me too. Thank you, Karen and Dennis. Show and tell, what's your mystery object and what does it say about you?
This is a Daruma, which is a Japanese doll, for want of a better label. You'll very often see them in Japanese companies with one of the eyes coloured in. The Daruma was a monk who basically spent his life in a cave contemplating the universe till his arms and legs fell off. Well, given that I started life in health and safety at work, it was, of course, intriguing for me. So that's one of the issues that I think it speaks to. And the other two really relate to the notion of persistence, that we have to constantly try and self-improve. But the third thing is really about self-reflection. That one of the things that the Daruma signifies is that you're always learning, you're always trying to improve, you're constantly trying to address your shortcomings, even though you might never achieve that and colour the other eye in.
Fantastic. Lots of self-reflection. And I love that it actually looks quite similar to you as well, Dennis.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a more acceptable version of me, really.
Wonderful. Julie, do introduce yourself with your mystery object.
My mystery object is an Olympic torch from the London 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games, which I was given by my boss having worked on the event. And for me, it says three things. It talks to purpose, determination, and balance. So the whole purpose of the Games was to inspire a generation to be active and look after their well-being. But actually, it had such a common purpose, and it taught me about how important it is to have purpose in what you do in your work and in organisations to have really clear purpose about what they're there to do. In terms of determination, it's proof of the art of possible. So I joined with 11 months to go. We did 4 years work in 11 months. It chimes with my own personal determination. But that links to the third point, which is balance. It's probably the piece of work I'm most proud of in my career, but I never want to work like that again. 4 years work in 11 months, completely unsustainable and not good for your mental health or well-being. It shows that it's possible in pursuit of short, big, hairy, audacious goals, but it's really not good for your well-being overall.
Short, big, hairy, audacious goals. What a great sentence. I love the fact also that the three objects that you have all brought have in some way brought around that self-reflection, so that you're allowing yourself that time to self-reflect when you're immersed in your books, Karen Ann, you're having all that holistic thinking, Dennis, and having had that experience, Julie, it's made you self-reflect. And so important that organizations as a whole, of course, are self-reflecting, isn't it? So let's kick on then with some questions around stopping well-being washing. First of all, let's start with you, Julie. What would you say well-being washing is, and why is it happening?
I think in the world of work, there's always a new thing, isn't there? And there's a zeitgeist. And I'm going to compare it with the advent of corporate social responsibility and the requirements to report on that. Having a strong employee value proposition, something that attracts people to your organisation, is super important. But there's a difference between ones that are genuine and founded and grounded and those which are just show. So lots of people got caught out with CSR reporting, saying nice words in their annual reports, but actually there was no substance behind it. And it soon started to unravel, and people got a competitive advantage or a differentiation in the marketplace by being genuine around some of these things. And I think it's the same with well-being. People say they look after their people, they have a well-being offer as part of their employee value proposition. It's all branded and it's beautiful. But then the first time somebody actually needs to access that support, whether it's from an individual manager and the way that they show up and look after their people, or whether it's through services that are provided as part of that proposition, if they find it not to be there, then it's a bit like the emperor's new clothes. And unfortunately, you only find that out when you come to need it. And so for me, well-being watching is about trying to make yourself more attractive as an employer and attract people into an organisation and tell a story about who you are when actually that might not really be true.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. And the same question for you then, Dennis. What would you say, what can you add to that in terms of what's well-being washing to you and why is it happening?
I think sometimes it's also tied into cognitive dissonance that people within the organisation think they're doing a really good job, but without actually asking the people who they manage whether they are doing a good job or not. And therefore, you get this dislocation between what people perceive as being the dominant culture in the organisation and what is the actual culture that's experienced by people. I also sometimes think, as I get older, that there's a generational thing as well, that I see it in academics where they look at younger academics and say, we had to do X, Y, and Z. Well, the reality is we didn't. Their job is much more difficult than ours was at the same age and stage of career. And we sometimes forget what it was like to be a new entrant into the organization and what it was like to have to try and meet ever-changing goals. And sometimes I think it's having that empathy with people below. And sadly, I would agree with Julie that a lot of it is a rhetoric on top of what is happening in the organisation, that we often don't go looking to find the real answer as to whether we're addressing well-being or not.
Yeah, not looking for the actual root cause. What would you add into that mix there, Karen Ann? What does well-being washing mean for you?
Yeah, I think it's already been said, but it's style over substance, really. And if I put my sustainability hat on, it's just the same as greenwashing. So companies that will throw a bunch of money at the climate problem to say that they are carbon neutral without actually addressing the root cause and doing anything further emissions. Well, being washing is the same. They'll throw up a wall of employee perks and hide behind that, so gym memberships or fruit at lunchtime and things like that, but they won't actually do anything to address the root cause of what's making people ill as a result of work. And it's easy to do that. That's probably why it's happening. It's easy. It makes a nice Instagram story for your social medias. It puts a nice public front on an organisation, but you're not actually changing anything for the employees that are working there day to day.
Yeah, so it's for ease that organisations are putting things in terms of surface. It looks good, but yeah, as you're all saying, it needs that substance, doesn't it? In three words, if you can, in three words, starting with you, Dennis, what do you notice in an organisation that is well-being washing?
I think I'm going to quote someone who taught me Jim Reason. Jim was a psychologist, and he argued that there were source types in organisations, and they were awareness, commitment and competence. And I think in many cases, when well-being washing takes place, those three elements are deficient. There isn't the awareness as to what the root causes of well-being might be. There isn't the commitment to actually change the culture in a fundamental way to address it. And there isn't the competence either. I teach in a business school. If I look at the curricula of a lot of MBA degrees, they don't address mental health in the workplace. They don't really address the fact that as a manager, you can create conditions that can make your colleagues ill. To address the issues, I think we've got to have an ongoing process of continuous professional development as managers to make certain that we develop that awareness, commitment and competence in order to overcome the problems of well-being washing.
Yeah, wow. Fantastic. A lot more than three words there, but good explanation of those three words. Karen Ann.
Sorry, I'm from Liverpool. I can't help it.
It's all great stuff. Karen Ann, what are your three words?
Perks. That's what you see. You'll see disengagement and you'll see apathy, I would say.
How does apathy show up?
Probably like presenteeism, people doing the bare minimum to get by, not going above and beyond, just disconnecting from the people around about you. If you don't have a culture where you can speak openly about mental health or talk about what's bothering you, why would you bother talking about it at all? So you just close off and become more isolated.
Thanks, Karen. And Julie, what are your three words?
For individuals, I think it's similar to Karen. I think you get disenfranchisement. People disconnect with the psychological contract with the organisation, which then means they disengage and then they become motivated. And so you're losing the horsepower that comes from having the people in your organisations. And people feel disillusioned with something that they've been promised that just isn't the real deal anymore.
What's the impact then of well-being washing? What's the real impact on individuals? Karen Ann, let's start with you on this question.
So this might be a bit of a spoiler, but mental health concerns don't go away if you ignore them. If anything, they only get worse. So if an individual suspects that their employer is well-being washing, they're not going to speak up and ask for help. They're not going to open up. So that in turn is going to lead to higher levels of stress and burnout. They might be more inclined to take work home to be able to keep up with what's expected of them at work, causing them to disconnect from family, not having enough downtime, not having that recovery time. So it erodes the trust in the organisation. And if your employees don't trust you, then you don't have a really good business at that point. You'll have undervalued employees who feel unseen, disengaged, and ultimately will either go off sick or they'll leave.
And Julie, what's your thoughts on that? What's the impact on individuals?
It's interesting for me, Amy, because we talk about the impact on individuals and organisation like they're separate things. Everybody gets very excited about organisations, their structures, their processes, what an organisation is. An organisation is just a collection of people. If your people didn't come to work again tomorrow, there is no organisation. So when we talk about the impact on individuals, there's the personal impact about how they feel, all the stuff that Karen Anna said about their commitment or otherwise to their workplace and how they show up and how they perform and their health and well-being generally. But there's also a much wider impact, therefore, on organisational performance, because every person is a cog in that wheel, and every cog that stops turning, you start to erode organisational performance. And so it's interesting to me when people talk about, well, organisational performance and individual performance, it's the same thing. It's always about the people. So if you have any impact on individuals, then you're eroding the value in your business, whether you're making money for shareholders or whether you're doing something that has an impact on society. Because those individuals will just disengage and they'll stop performing. They'll stop being the best version of themselves. And that's the only responsibility you have as a leader, create an environment that allows people to be the best version of themselves.
Wonderful. And Dennis, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. For me, if a manager doesn't do what he or she says the organization is espousing, it violates the moral code of the individual. And the minute you violate that moral code, you do turn that person from being a positive colleague to being one that is potentially quite damaging. And certainly the insider threat literature would point to that, that people become threats to the organization simply because they've had the moral code violated by managerial behaviors.
What do you mean by threat to the organization? Can you give more of an example around that?
Well, of course, in the US, it's been manifested in violent acts. So the whole notion of going postal, which is a term used within that literature, points to the fact that people who have become disgruntled at work can actually eventually cause harm to the organization. It can be things as low level as sabotage. You know, I'm not going to do the job to the best of my ability, therefore I'm degrading the performance of the organization. Or an individual has bullied me at work and I'm, you know, I'll get to a point where I won't take it anymore. And you see a lot of evidence of well-performing, good employees being turned into quite hostile people to the organization. And then they get blamed for that. But the reality is that the organization has contributed to that process. It's so easy to blame the individual without actually stepping back and saying, what did we do to contribute to this?
Or, of course, there's the other side as well, isn't there, where actually you've got a fantastic individual in your team, but because those values aren't met, one thing's being espoused, but it's not actually happening, they leave. So you lose all that talent because they're like, I'm not standing for this, I'm out of here. So that can be another impact, right?
And then there's the issue of suicide at work. People are pushed to the point where they can no longer cope. And rather than see it purely and simply in terms of them and their characteristics and their problems, we need to reflect on what on earth did we do to not only to contribute to that, but to actually pick up on some of the early warning signs. And I know that I've experienced that sadly with a former colleague who committed suicide. And a lot of us felt, you know, why didn't we pick up on these early warnings? And if we did, you know, what would we have done? And for me, that was a real game changer in terms of my understanding of some of the challenges that we face managerially around managing mental health at work. I didn't manage the individual. He was a colleague in that sense.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because we find that sometimes organizations find it hard just to get on the journey in terms of mental health in the workplace. So broaching the subject of suicide is a whole other level. Yeah. And sadly, in organizations where there has been suicide, there's still that reluctance to start the process. And yet they'll also say, oh, we're doing all these shiny things. Any thoughts on that, Karen Ann?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. And it's, like we said at the start, it's the easy way out. If you want to really actively work at improving employee wellbeing, you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because the first time you do a survey or start asking the questions, you probably won't like the answers that you get back. And if you're not prepared to then follow up on that, then there's really no point in starting the process. It's not easy, it's not glamorous, it's not going to make good social media content, but it's what's going to drive real change in the organisation, and you need to put the hours in.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. So it's about being okay to be uncomfortable, as you said. So what does well-being washing mean in real terms to an organisation, like the opportunity cost? We'll start with you, Julie, on this one. But first of all, I just want to give an example. One of our senior advisors is a former divisional commander of Police Scotland, and he made it his mission to make workplace well-being sort of golden thread that ran through the organisation. And as a direct result of all the work that they put in to create a mentally healthy culture, in real terms, it meant they had 40 more cops on the beat. So that's a lot of absenteeism has been reduced, if you like, people feeling more happy, able, healthy, motivated to come to work. Julie, what are your thoughts in terms of the real opportunity cost, if you like?
Well, and it links back to the point I made earlier about organisations' performance is vested in its people. For people to perform at their best, they need to feel safe. And I mean safe in the broadest sense, not just in a technical sense. They need to feel like they're in an environment where they can thrive, where they are supported in what they do. And if you have that, you get the best out of people, because you create a level of safety, which means they will ask for help. They will talk about things where they've got challenges. To Dennis's point, you'll be able to spot early warning signs, nip things in the bud, And with your example there, therefore reduce absenteeism, put support in place early. Prevention is always better than cure, right? So you spot those signs earlier and you have a more productive, and productive, I mean, in the broadest sense, happy, healthy, productive workforce. And so the cost of not doing this is the corollary. And if I just pick up on the points that Dennis and Karen Ann made earlier, it is your duty of care as an organisation to do this for your employees. Right? It is your obligation, your responsibility. And when I work with organisations going through change, it's a lot about having to change people's behaviour. And they point to individuals who might be obstructive. And I remember one particular program, everybody complained about this poor lady called Ruth who worked in procurement and just said no the whole time. And all you heard was about complaints about this person. And then you sat and had the conversation in a different way and said, do you think Ruth comes to work every day to be unhelpful? Do you think that's what gets her out of bed in the morning, to come here and say no to people? It's not. It's the organisation has done that to her. It has put processes, policies, systems around her, which means that's the only outcome she can give you. It's not her responsibility. It's the organisation's responsibility. They've created an environment that have made her show up in that way. You change that, you change Ruth. It's not Ruth's problem. It's the organisation and its duty of care and its obligation to create a safe, supportive, productive environment. And to Karen Ann's point, if I may, about being uncomfortable, in my work in the healthcare system, nobody talks about death. And it's a bit about the suicide point that's been made earlier. And I remember an end-of-life care nurse going into a boardroom to do a presentation on their service. And they just asked everybody in the boardroom, said, can you just all please say the word dead, death, dying? Just keep saying it. And everybody felt really uncomfortable because they would all say, oh, gone to a better place, passed on, no longer with us. We don't even use the words that these things mean. And her whole presentation was about making that group of people feel uncomfortable and get comfortable with having a conversation that none of us have because nobody wants to have it. But if we don't have it, we have a bad death and we have a bad end of life. And it's exactly the same parallels with Karen Ann's point. If we don't have conversations in our organisation about what we're not doing right, about where we're letting people down, about getting comfortable with talking about topics that nobody wants to talk about, like the thought of a colleague committing suicide, we will never make progress. And so the opportunity cost of not doing that is you've got unsafe, unsupported, unproductive people and your organisational performance suffers. There's a simple corollary between those things for me.
Absolutely. I just want to pick up on the terminology as well in terms of commit suicide, because we aim not to use that terminology now. That comes from when suicide was illegal, and it has an impact again on how we think about it and our ability to talk about it, right? And so, yeah, it's about changing up the language that we're using and using the language that we want people to talk about. Dennis, what does it mean in real terms to an organization? What's the opportunity cost from your perspective?
So before I answer that, I used the term commit suicide before, because for my generation, that was the term that was often used. And I think you've made a really good point there, because no one has ever corrected me on the use of that term. Not that I use it on a day-to-day basis, although I should say I was taught by Jesuits. I was told from an early age I was going to burn in hell. So, you know, in some respects, I'm sort of used to that doom and gloom perspective because I'm a risk analyst. The thing that bothers me is remote working. So what organizations have done is they've looked at the space that they have and they've said, we can utilize that resource better by getting people to work at home. We can sell off our buildings. But the problem is we now have no means of picking up on early warnings about the behaviors of colleagues, people who might be stressed, people who are sat in a bedsit on their own day in and day out trying to work. They've got no separation between home and work. Now, I'm an academic, I'm used to that. But for a lot of my younger colleagues, they miss on that social interaction that was important to their well-being. And I think, in a way, it's the sort of other side of the opportunity cost comment, because what we've got is really a sort of deficit potential here that we are creating. We're embedding a problem for some of our colleagues in terms of mental health that will only emerge in maybe 5-10 years time. And then we'll say, oh, isn't this awful? How did it happen? But really, we can see it happening in front of us now in real time.
Yeah. That's a whole other panel event on hybrid working, let me tell you.
This is about spotting signs. Sorry, Amy, if I may. I was chief executive of a safety organisation 15 years ago, and we were dealing with the legacy of industrial safety challenges. So things like mesothelioma and injuries and long-term health conditions that were caused by the conditions that people were working in. And already 15 years ago, they were saying, well, the next big challenge is going to be the amount of screen time that we all have. And that was 15 years ago, before we had hybrid working. So we knew about this and we know it's coming. We can see what the next challenge is. So where are the conversations proactively in organisations about thinking about well-being in that broader sense? Not we can make everybody more productive and save money because they're all working from home, but what's the long-term cost to that, to the kind of social capital that you create in organisations with people being together, as well as the physical health issues that this will cause from us all staring at screens?
Can I pick up on that? Because I think what the mesothelioma case and pneumoconiosis also illustrate is that lag time where managers will deny that there's a problem. And then there's a period after that where managers very often think, not on my watch. And therefore, you know, it gets kicked into the long grass. And I think remote working, screen time, all of these issues have been to an extent kicked into the long grass, because a bit like CSR, you know, it's a long-term strategic process, but management very often focuses on short-term goals where they can either show return to stakeholders or shareholders or to the people above them that we've made this contribution. And I think short-termism is one of the single biggest problems we have to overcome in order to address some of these issues around well-being in the workplace.
Yeah. And as I said, there's an awful lot still discussion going on in terms of hybrid and the impact of hybrid, but also the impact. I was reading an article quite recently about the impact of seeing you've all got to be back in the workplace, you've all got to be back in the office, when people have become used to a more flexible way of working. So it's a fine line, and I think it's different for every organisation. At least that's what we're finding when speaking to different clients. There's lots of ways that this can work for organisations. Equally, there is, as you say, quite a big downside if people aren't physically getting in the room together on a regular basis. Dennis, a double question. So what's in it for organisations to walk the talk, and how do we encourage them to do it?
I'm possibly the worst person to answer that question, because as far as I'm concerned, what's in it for organisations? It's what they're supposed to do. It's not some sort of add-on that's optional. It's a core organisational and managerial requirement to look after the health, safety and welfare of people in your organisation. 1974 Health and Safety at Work Act has welfare in it. You know, in a sense, we shouldn't be preaching to the converted, right? So that's the rant over with. What was the second part of the question?
How do we encourage organisations to take that core notion of look after your people? How do we encourage them to walk the talk in terms of no more well-being washing?
I think that's back to that CSR issue again, you know, because for many organisations, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, well-being is an intangible. It's not something that immediately appears on the bottom line. It's not something that is very often addressed in, you know, management performance appraisals. It's not something that we as a collective in an organisation are encouraged to do in terms of our colleagues. And it's back to that three elements of culture: awareness, commitment and competence. We really have to drive home those issues in the same way that happened with health and safety at work, but it took a long time to change that culture to make managers much more aware about their responsibilities in terms of dealing with safety in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely.
And really, mental health is an aspect of that.
And we would argue that there is a real-time cost, and you can work out how much it's costing your organisation. We promote the use of the NICE costing tool, for example, to help organisations to realise the actual cost. It still sticks with me, though, that actually you've got to say, look, it's costing you this much, when it should just be a natural thing. As you said earlier, Dennis, it should be, we just do this because this is the way we exist. Karen-Anne, what are your thoughts? How do we encourage organisations to stop well-being washing and start walking the talk?
Yeah, I think the parallels with health and safety are good ones. It is a legal requirement. There's no getting away for that. In the UK and other countries in Europe, we have to manage psychosocial risks in the workplace. That's black and white. I think trying to appeal to organisations in the same way as we would have done in terms of health and safety 20, 30 years ago. If someone's off work with recovering from an operation, or if they break their leg, we are more than happy to make all the adjustments needed to bring them back to work in a good way and to keep them with us. We don't have that same level of maturity when it comes to people who are off with a mental health issue. There's still this kind of fear around how we bring them back into the workplace, and we need to get the same willingness to put adaptations in place to help keep people at work and help them thrive at work as we would do for a physical safety concern or a physical injury that someone's had at work.
When you look at what's happening globally and in general in the UK, we're doing pretty well, but there's still a long way to go, isn't it? I know you've got that sort of global outlook, haven't you, Karen Ann? Do you want to share a little bit about the work that's going on in Volvo in South Korea, for example?
Yeah, so there is a long way to go. And even within Volvo, we still have this debate between whether it's work-related mental health or it's personal mental health. And for me, and the message that we're trying to get across is it really doesn't matter, because you don't just look after the employee that's there for 8 hours of the day. You have to look after the whole person. And people are messy and they're complicated, and life is going to interfere with work, and vice versa. So as part of our safety awards every year, we have a mental health category. And this year, I think we got about 20 applications. And when we selected the top three, one of the applications from Korea was one of the ones that made the top three, just in terms of what they're doing as a site within South Korea to challenge the stigma, to try and address the suicide rates that exist there. They're really trying to open up the conversations about mental health in the workplace, make it okay. They have brought in support in terms of coaches and psychologists and different kind of support mechanisms for people to talk to. And it doesn't matter if it's work-related or not work-related. But the reason that application stood out for us that we're selecting the top three was just because of where they are in terms of a cultural journey as a country. So it's really interesting to see the different approaches in the Volvo Group. We have a Swedish headquarters. They're very far advanced in mental health, talking about psychosocial risks. Same for sites in Europe, but we have sites all over the world. We're in South Korea, we're in India, we're in China, we're in the US, where they all have very different approaches to mental health and wellbeing, and very different of stigma still attached to men. It's interesting to see different parts of the organisation.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we can learn from other parts of the world and how people are, it sounds like everywhere we're having to work to question some viewpoints within society, and in some places more so than others. Julie, what's in it for the organisation to walk the talk, and how do we encourage them to do so?
I'm with everybody here that there's a basic human principle here, isn't there? That there's the humanity and obligation to take care of one another. And frankly, that's a whole bigger debate. If we all did that every day, the world would be a nicer place, wouldn't it? Yeah. But I think there's also that when theory meets reality, I've yet to meet anybody who comes home from work every day feeling like they got everything done on their to-do list. And so there are too many competing demands in organisations very often. And so things don't get prioritised. And ultimately, that's why organisations have levers and incentives. So whether it's what gets measured, gets managed, and all those kinds of analogies, to actually change a culture, you have to make it consequential. And all of my transformation work around changing cultures, I see people, there's three steps to this. Be really clear about the ask, put the support in place to make it happen, and then apply consequences. People don't like the word consequences. It can be positive consequences, but there has to be a consequence for behaving in the way you want people to behave or not. And it's exactly the same with organisations here. If you want a culture that prizes well-being, you have to really clearly articulate the what. What does that mean for us? What's the ask? You then have to make sure you've got all the support in place for that to happen. So whether it's the services, the tools, the infrastructure, or equipping your managers with the skills to be able to do this well, because this might be a new way of working for people, so that all of the excuses are taken away then, because you've got the ask. You can't have people saying, I didn't know how to do it. You do all of that first, and only then can you start to hold people to account, measure, manage, and apply consequences. And then you use the levers and incentives that you have in any organisation around how you manage performance, or how you distribute reward, if it's financial or otherwise, or recognition in other ways. And you incentivise people to do the right thing. Because when their to-do lists have got dozens of things on it, and they can't see the immediate benefit of this compared to other things, it will fall down the list. So there's something about making it really tangible and gritty and consequential, so it puts it top of mind and equips people to be able to do the right thing every day, because ultimately people will make choices and they'll go to where the levers and incentives are.
Yeah, fantastic points. I'd just like to bring Angus in, and we'll have a look at some of the thoughts and comments that people have been putting into the chat. So Angus, what's been said in there?
We have a lot of comments going on. So I've got one here from Casey Fitzpatrick. Good to see you there, Casey. And it's for Karen Ann. Do you see the health and safety executive holding organisations to account for well-being? I know that the HSE are looking more at work-related stress and pulling organisations up. What do you reckon, Karen Ann?
As far as I know, they already are. There's already been some cases that have been brought against businesses for not managing psychosocial risk. You know, it is a legal requirement. We do have to follow the management standards. And I think we'll probably see more of that going forward. Julie and Dennis were saying there's this lagging period and we're going to see an increase in work-related mental health probably a few years down the line. So I think we'll see enforcement action increase. Not that that's what should drive the change. We shouldn't be making changes and investing in wellbeing because we're scared of prosecution. We should be doing it for all the reasons that we've talked about. But I absolutely think that we'll see an increase going forward.
Thank you. I've got one good one here from Andy Thompson. Are there any examples of shareholders paying attention to wellbeing investments? They ultimately drive the reward for senior leaders and CSR. And has there been good examples of that? Julie, what do you reckon?
I haven't seen any yet, but it's the greatest lever and incentive, I think, in the corporate world if you suddenly get a shareholder rebellion over this. Or you get.
We have been working with an organisation where they're owned by a private equity company. And private equity, as everybody knows, has a pretty bad reputation for really screwing down on the numbers. This private equity company has two companies they own, which are in the top 10 best places to work in the Sunday Times. Yeah. And that is obviously deliberate. It's a deliberate policy where the shareholders are guiding the company they own to do this type of thing. I think that is a fascinating example. And it's also incredibly rare. But great question there, Andy. Thank you.
Yeah, brilliant. I wanted to go back to actually what you said, Julie, around consequences for an organisation. Something tangible, you said, something gritty. What, in your opinion, should those consequences be?
So I think everybody's performance should be measured on two dimensions. We measure performance one-dimensionally, which is on task, and we don't measure behaviours. And it's completely measurable. You can measure the impact of a change in culture. It's all tangible. And if you get to a place where you manage performance on both task and behaviour, then you can incentivise a collective change around that. So if prioritising well-being, if showing up in a way which has more empathy, more consideration, more flexibility for people's needs, accessing and actively promoting support around well-being that might exist in the organisation, allowing people time to commit to initiatives or the lunchtime yoga meetup, whatever it is that's been put in place, and you actually codify that into people's performance requirements and you manage people's performance against it, it's the easiest way of making culture consequential and actions consequential. And so few organisations want to do it. And I think it's a bigger challenge. I think it's because performance management and objective setting is so rigid. And I think forward-thinking organisations have moved away from annual appraisals and annual objectives, and they set much more agile and iterative priorities throughout the year, and it drives performance faster. So if you've got somebody who isn't participating, a manager who isn't participating in the wellbeing agenda, you can start asking why, you can put the support in place, you can then start saying, I expect you in the next 3 months to have shown up and done these things. And it's a short window where you drive change faster than if you just put a big global objective at the start of the year, which feels intangible and not personal to that individual. If every individual makes a contribution in a different way, the collective is much, much greater than the sum of its parts. So it all comes to about how you task people and what you're asking them to do every day for me.
That actually links really nicely, Julie, to a question from Chris Abbey. Again, good to see you, Chris. I think that some companies and leaders are uncomfortable in tackling the problem, therefore do the minimum. Dennis, what would you say to that?
I think in a lot of cases, organizations recruit managers against all the wrong criteria. So that's what makes them feel uncomfortable. There's an interesting argument by one of the founding fathers of research into psychopathy in the US who did his work in prisons initially, but he said if he was doing it now, he'd do it on Wall Street because, you know, a lot of the characteristics that those organizations recruit to, being driven, being highly focused, being really motivated to get the job done, are actually potentially negative characteristics in terms of building a culture of well-being in the organization. So it becomes a focus on the individual rather than the collective, which speaks to comments made by both Karen and Julie before. If we don't change that, you know, we're then going to find it really hard to change the individual, because they're going to say, but I was recruited to do X, Y, and Z, and that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm driving profit. I'm driving down overhead costs. I'm doing all the things that I'm being asked to do. Mental health wasn't on that list. Well-being wasn't on that list. And I think if we're not careful, if we don't take a holistic view of this issue, we'll develop a reductionist approach to dealing with it, where we'll actually put a gloss on some of the things that we do without changing the fundamental characteristics of the organization to make us recognize that well-being at work is a key managerial task.
We so often hear there's a lack of confidence. People are scared. They don't talk about it. They don't have those difficult conversations. And building that confidence is so, so important to getting this into the mainstream.
Catherine Tierney has said, I'll point this one to you first, Karen Ann. She says, I'm interested to know how best, and it ties in really with what Dennis was talking about. I'm interested in how best to mainstream wellbeing rather than see it as this add-on. It should be central to most or all decisions.
I think part of that, Dennis hit the nail on the head with the way that we recruit leaders and managers, and it's often done for very technically competent reasons. They're very good at their job, but they don't have the people skills necessarily to lead teams effectively or get the most out of them. And I think the biggest thing we can do to make it mainstream is to make sure that leaders at all levels of the business walk the talk. You know, it's no good having a robust wellbeing program in place if you have senior leaders who send emails when they're on vacation, send emails at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, are contactable while they're in hospital. That sets your tone, that sets your culture, and that filters down through all levels, because then other people feel that they can't take time off if they're sick. My boss kept working while he was in hospital or while he was on vacation. So that sets your culture. So we really need to get change from the top for it to become mainstream and accepted throughout the whole organisation.
Absolutely. And it's about that constant search also, isn't it, for what are the potential stressors in the organisation? So you're actually getting to the root cause of stuff. Mm. And those discussions are happening at every level within an organisation. And it's about that openness, isn't it, to cause and effect and how people are dealing with that. I know there's lots more thoughts and comments in the chat. Thank you for sharing that. Karen Ann, would you like to kick off by telling us a little bit more about commit to culture change as a top tip?
You have to be uncomfortable. You have to get in about the detail, and it's going to take time to see sustainable change happen.
Great. And that probably ties into your second point there.
Yeah. So I put listen to your employees, but I think probably it's more realistic to say hear your employees. I think a lot of organisations are great at listening. They'll put out survey after survey. They'll get all the information, but they don't hear what people are telling them. So actually listen to what they're saying, understand what they're saying, and then do something with that, as opposed to just putting it in a drawer and asking the same question next year.
Thank you, Karen Ann. Moving on to you, Dennis. Be willing to call out poor managerial practices /BS around mental health and its causal factors.
Obviously, I work in a business school, which is what BS stands for. So I'd hate anybody to think it was a pejorative term. This might be heresy to some people. Stop talking about risk. Risk is probability and consequence. We can't measure the probabilities associated with the behavior of human actors. We should talk about vulnerability and the consequences associated with vulnerability. But the minute we say, oh, it's low risk, we kick it into the long grass. But we've got no evidence base for making that judgment as to whether it's low risk. The Titanic only sank once, right? It was a low probability, high consequence event. There was no prior indication of a failure associated with that system. And in terms of a lot of mental health and well-being in the workplace, we don't have that prior knowledge to allow us to calculate effective probabilities with predictive validity. So stop pretending that it's a risk that we can manage. It's a vulnerability we can manage. And the consequences are things that we have to address. And I think that obsession with calculative practices is a means of allowing some managers to kick well-being issues into the long grass. Rant over.
Thank you. Second point, engage in a process of self-reflection.
Which I will do over a cup of coffee afterwards. I think we all have to think about how our actions might impact on others. You know, that we should manage our colleagues in a way that we would like to be managed ourselves.
Great.
Rather than take a command and control managerialist approach, which is very often what you see in practice. But, you know, to think about what are the likely consequences, irrespective of probability, what are the likely consequences associated with this action on people who are having to deal with a job at the sharp end? And it's back to that point about management behaviours, that people lead by example. And really, that self-reflection process is important.
Thank you, Dennis. Julie, lead authentically with people genuinely at the heart of every decision.
I think this comes back to some of the points I've made in the debate, Amy. I see too many managers and leaders in organisation who focus on objectives and deliverables and the tasks, and they forget that the only way any of that happens is that performance comes through their people. And I think if people start with the, how do I get the best out of my people, then everything else follows, whether it's profit or purpose, whatever it is you're in pursuit of, you start with, how do I get the best out of my people? And guess what? We're not robots and we're all different. And some people will need managing in different ways to others. How many people have actually sat down with their teams and said, how will I get the best out of you? What do you want to see more of or less of from me to help you deliver to your best? What are you missing? What can I help with? If you have a people-centered approach to leadership, you will automatically get the best out of your people, and you will create a level of safety and trust which will enable them to talk to you if they've got an issue. And that's where you gain signs.
And finally, promote a culture of feedback.
Every high-performing culture I've seen in organisations has feedback at its heart. It's not a word that people dread. It's not a word that people fear because they think it's going to be something I've done wrong. People ask for and seek feedback all the time. They ask and check in. How are you? How am I doing? Could I have done better there? Is there something more I could do? What do you want more or less of? It's just a ready part of the conversation. It's not something that happens in an appraisal. And I think having that open feedback culture allows you, again, to pick up on the early warning signs and to genuinely be connected with the true well-being of your workforce, because they'll talk to you.
Fantastic. Thank you. One very quick fire question for each of you. Are you ready? Dennis, what's one of the kindest things you've noticed at work?
Oh, gosh. I mean, simply picking up on that point that people will say, how are you?
Thank you. Julie, if you could create a new award for someone at work, what would it be for?
Oh, the person with the greatest amount of curiosity.
Oh, I love that. Karen Ann, what does vulnerability mean to you?
Being uncomfortable.
And on that very comfortable note, I'm going to hand over to Angus. Thank you, everyone.
This is absolute gold dust. Everybody should have this. Everybody should hear this. It's so important. The passion that you guys have, the knowledge, the expertise, the experience, this needs to go out to a much wider audience. And I hope that when people listen to this, they will take it on board and they will apply that expertise, that knowledge, that passion that you have, because this is how to do it. It isn't difficult stuff. Julie, you say, start with how do we get the best out of our people? Just ask that question. It's not rocket science, but it's a great starting point. And Karen Ann, you're talking about style over substance and addressing the root causes. Addressing those root causes of stress is, we believe, one of the key things that you have to do. If you're not doing it, you're only ever going to be washing over it. Yeah, it's so important. And Dennis, this is really simple. This is what we are supposed to be doing. It's not difficult. It's what we're supposed to do at work, is look after our people. So I would like to thank you on behalf of everybody here and everybody that's going to listen to this as a podcast. Thank you all very, very much. We greatly appreciate it. We love your passion. We love your expertise. And thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you on the Wellbeing Hour. And on the Wellbeing Hour coming up, the next one is with Chris Abbey, who's here today. Thank you, Chris, for coming along. And Chris is Senior Vice President of HSE for UK, Ireland and Nordics for Altrad. Altrad is a very large industrial services company based in France and covers across the UK as well and the world. That is on 15th May, is at 12 noon. So sign up for it. It's going to be a cracker. We're going to be talking about what way is up, understanding perspectives. some dates for your diary as well. We also have, we are at Women in Nuclear, and Amy and myself are doing a live event there. So if you're anywhere near Manchester, I know you are at the moment, Dennis, but if you're anywhere near Manchester, then come along, see us, visit us at Stand 17. 15th May, we have the Wellbeing Hour there with Chris. On 26th June, we have the Wellbeing Hour with Ollie Follain, MBE, Head of Process at Optimus Plus and a visiting professor at the University of Dundee. 23rd July, we have Adrienne Kelby, CBE. She's a leadership coach and non-exec director, former head of the Office for Nuclear Regulation and the first patron of Women in Nuclear UK. That is at a different time. It's at 2:30 in the afternoon. Stay in touch. Please follow us on LinkedIn. It does make a difference, and you'll see what we're doing there in terms of these events. We have solutions for all levels of organisations, from senior leaders to people managers to direct and indirect staff. Somewhere there is a QR code, which is coming up. There it is. Yep. So if you want to get in touch with us, scan that QR code. We will come along and talk to you and have a free consultation in terms of mental health. It's a great pleasure and it's a great honour to run the Wellbeing Hour. On behalf of all of us at Head Torch, thank you for coming along. Thank you for giving your time. And that is it from the Wellbeing Hour today. Have great days, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wellbeing Hour. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. These events take place regularly, so do join us for more. And if your organisation would like to develop a mentally healthy culture, we'd be happy to work with your senior team, people managers, and frontline staff. Please get in touch at headtorch.org. We look forward to hearing from you.